The flexibility of the teachers and the willingness of everybody to work together made all the difference in the world.
I think that building relationships isn't a sprint, it's a marathon.
Ooh, we'd be really wealthy if we figured this one out, wouldn't we?
Welcome to Love is a Classroom, Stories of Inclusion, a podcast that aims to serve as a bridge for a more inclusive world. I'm your host, Andrew Goff. This special episode is about advocating for a child with a disability or who is neurodivergent. It features a panel of three distinguished parent advocates. The panelists share their experiences, stories, and professional knowledge. They talk about building meaningful relationships with IEP and IFSP team members, advocating when, from a parental perspective, the district data isn't sufficient, continuity between classrooms, schools, and district policies, and influencing change in culture and policy through meaningful relationship. The advocacy panel was recorded as a launch event for my memoir, Love is a Classroom. The topics discussed come from experiences I share in the memoir from the perspective of a teacher. I hope you enjoy the panel as much as I did. I am so privileged to have with us tonight for this parent advocacy panel, three amazing individuals who can speak with great passion on the topic of parent advocacy. So let me quickly go around and I'll let you introduce yourself, panelist, and then we'll jump into the questions. Let's start out with Beth.
I'm Beth Cole. I am the parent of a 31-year-old with autism who is diagnosed at the age of 2.5. So he was in early intervention for probably a total of 4 months. And it really sparked my passion for early intervention because if he had gotten in earlier, we would have had more time. And I started my career in early intervention a year after his diagnosis by being a parent advocate. And so I worked as a para educator in the school where my son was. I wasn't in his classroom. That would not have worked. But it was really helpful being in the school. But I've worked in the field of early intervention now since 1996. And I've been at the local level with a Part C local agency, as well as the state level agency. And now I work for a national technical assistance center and provide support to state level Part C programs.
Thanks for being part of this panel. I'll hand it over to Sarah.
Thank you so much, Andrea. This is so exciting to have your book out. I'm Sarah Davidon. I am a mom of two now teenagers, a 15 and a 16-year-old. And I also have worked in the field of early childhood, specifically around early childhood systems development and developmental health systems and the inclusion of behavioral health and mental health into early childhood systems. I think I'm coming at this, my lens tonight is both as a parent advocating for both of my kids as they grew and when they were younger, both of them with different types of special health care needs. And also as this filter of having a sort of a lens of what systems, what we think systems should look like, and sometimes having to navigate what we do as parents when they don't look like that.
Thank you, Sarah. Thank you for joining us. And Kim.
Hi, everyone. Glad to be here. Kim Travers. I'm from Ohio. I have two teens as well, almost a complete adult. So I have a 21-year-old and a 17-year-old. My 17-year-old has autism, ADHD, and anxiety. Both kids were born preemies, entered into the world as a preemie mom, right into early intervention for both of them. And then their journeys transition. But my 17-year-old has had an IFSP or an IEP since the beginning. And so we'll finish the system in that way. But we're preparing to transition into adulthood, which is a new whole system, learning all of that process. I have worked in early intervention since 1994 when it was called Part H. So I actually started a little differently. I started the opposite of Beth. I started working in the field as a service coordinator and developmental specialist, worked my way up, was recognized for some work around children with special health care needs and that coordination of systems, and worked for Indiana's Part C system as a state consultant, and then did some national work and then moved back to Ohio home. So I've worked at a lot of different local, state, and national levels, a lot around policy and early intervention, the implementation, that program level, systems level, and also at the university levels and institutions of higher ed, really making sure that we're getting pre-service professionals ready for the field in the eye. So it's pretty exciting to have the opportunity to work on some OSEP-funded personnel preparation grants. So great. Excited to be here.
Yeah. And so we've got the lens of individuals who are really working at the top and working in the trenches simultaneously. So I really appreciate it all. We're going to go ahead and we're going to move through three questions tonight. Those are our primary questions. If you're with us here, then you can go ahead and ask further questions in the chat. So let's go ahead and get started. Our first question, how can teachers, service providers, and district representatives make meaningful, authentic, responsive connections with families and students who have IEPs or IFSPs?
I can start. For me, as my son was going through school, I had really solid relationships with his teachers, and we were a team. And when things weren't going so well, they connected with me and they asked me, how can we work on this? What are you doing at home? How can we transition that to what we're doing at school? But I think the most telling experience was when my son was in kindergarten, because the kindergarten was actually part of a nearby nursing home. And the idea was to have an intergenerational experience for everybody. The classroom was small, and my son had sensory issues, and he was a runner, and he would escape, and he would run through the halls with all of these people who have walkers and canes and everything, and it was really dangerous for him to be running around. And after a couple of months, his teacher and the administration and I met and said, this isn't working, so let's think about where can we have him that will be successful. And we thought about having him in the first grade class because he was old as a kindergartner. He turned six right as he started kindergarten. But the first grade class was essentially two classes together. And it was just too many people, too much chaos. And so they decided to put him in with a mixed second, third grade class that was headed by a special education teacher. And having him in that class with kids older than him who weren't afraid to say, hey, Raymond, stop that, was a whopping success. And I think the creativity of the administration and the flexibility of the teachers and the willingness of everybody to work together made all the difference in the world. And he was in that school all the way through eighth grade. And it was a rousing success. I really loved their attitude of, let's give it a try. Let's see what's working. And if this isn't working, then we can try something else. But let's give this a try.
Yeah, seems like they figured out what worked.
They did.
All right, thanks for sharing that. Someone else like to take that?
I think one of the pieces that is really critical is building authentic relationships by asking, tell me what your day typically looks like. What do you love about your child? What do you want to see your child do in the next year, in the next 5 years? What do you want their life to be? That's the point of education, is to develop so we can become productive citizens in the world. And I think that's why inclusion is so important. They need to be a part of their world every step of the process and every step in that journey. I feel like every time we get into an IEP meeting or we talk about issues, we're rushed. We got to get through this. We have an hour. We have everyone together. That's not authentic. That's like painful. Or asking a parent, what do you want the goals to be? Deer in the headlights, right? So it's about conversations, asking questions, and not the surface level questions, going a little deeper, taking some time, letting people have the questions before the meeting so they can think about it, talk with a loved one. All of those things are really important that create those authentic relationships. I'm like Beth, I had an amazing intervention specialist for my youngest between kindergarten and fifth grade. We had the same person. And she was really looking at those, what makes Kirsten amazingly unique and how do we help keep building on the skills where she has strengths? So we weren't just looking at the deficits. Guess what? My kid couldn't add in third grade. My kids still can't add in 11th grade. We don't care. Ultimately, we're looking at function. And so that was where she was like, let's focus on what we can do and work on and continue to build what we're not yet doing. But it wasn't our total focus. And so I think that balance between helping parents know what we want educationally, developmentally, and socially for kids, and then how we connect those pieces together and having conversations about what's meaningful for families. That's huge. If we can get that win, just have a conversation with families, not about the academics, but their goals and visions for their kid and the student themselves. What are their goals?
You had said you recognize that often we're rushed, and coming from the special education from public school, I can totally feel that.
Yes.
When you've got seven people at that meeting, everybody has their own thing, but we have that hour to get it done. What role does a teacher play in that? What role does a family play in that in still maintaining that authentic connection, despite still there's really no choice in the matter? You're going to be rushed when you've got seven people working in the public school district being pulled in 10 different ways. Right. So how do you reconcile that tension that's created when the reality of this limited time, but yet we want to have those authentic, meaningful connections?
Yeah. Here's my gut response, and you all please add in with me. I think that the issue is we're trying to build relationships during that meeting. The relationships have to be built across time and continuously. So it's not a one and done. We shouldn't be talking with this team just at the meeting. So it's like, how do we have email, text? We have so much technology where we can get people thinking so that when you come to the meeting, you're prepared. Don't ask someone to think at the meeting. My brain is like, oh my God, all these people in the room. I got to go through this process. Is everything where it needs to be? That should be a fine-tuned editing and like a final review. Think about your book. You didn't write your book in a day. It was 2 years. It was a process. So it's like thinking about that same thing when we're doing this with families. Help them have the playbook, first of all. What is their role? What are the different roles? What are we expecting? And then just taking time, a quick email. I hate, but send out a questionnaire with two questions on it. Tell me what your kid loves to do today, or what did you do fun over the summer? And it has to be continuous. And I know that takes effort, but I think that's the way we get to building these authentic relationships that make the IEP meetings or IFSP meetings where we're sitting down and actually writing the final document more authentic.
One thing to add to that would be how important it is to have the teachers as part of this, because the teacher is the one realistically that has the most access to those relationships, right? Because the speech pathologist or the occupational therapist or whomever, they have perhaps less time, less opportunity. The teacher serves as that conduit to a certain extent. Sarah, do you want to add anything?
So a couple of things. I really appreciate Kim pointing out that these weren't your words, but I'll change them into different words. But I think that building relationships isn't a sprint, it's a marathon. I'm speaking from the perspective of a child who actually never had and never became eligible for an IEP or an IFSP after years and years of trying. And so I guess I would push the edges of this question outward a little bit more around the building of relationships. It's most effective if those happen even before there's an eligibility for a plan. So when my son was having pretty significant behavioral health issues when he was in preschool, and I would get those phone calls in the middle of the day. Fortunately, I had some flexibility with my work. You've got to come pick up your son. You've got to come pick up your son. It would have been an amazing experience if those relationships were built around getting to know one another rather than waiting for something acute to happen. So I guess I would just want to reinforce that this building of meaningful, authentic, and responsive connections can start earlier than when a formalized plan is in place.
Absolutely. Closing thoughts on that question.
My only closing thought is that most of Raymond's IEPs were written before the meeting, where I was working with the classroom teacher, I was working with the speech therapist and the occupational therapist to make sure that whatever they were doing was dovetailing with what I was doing outside of the school, but also that we were collaborating with what might work within the classroom. And it was focused on more than just academics.
Yes. Let's go to our next question. How can we support families and children who warrant accommodations or modifications that extend beyond data from evaluations?
I'll jump in because this is feeling, even though it's not in the context of early childhood at this point, it very well could and should have been when my kids were younger. I'm coming to this panel on the heels of having a phone call yesterday afternoon with my son's school. So he's in high school now, that the data showed that he was ineligible for a 504 plan. So this is keeping in mind after about 14 years of really trying to figure out like what's going on and how can we best support him and how can I best help support people who are teaching him and who are in other parts of his life. He continues to be found ineligible, and specifically because of the data that's being reflected. So this is feeling very poignant right now. And I guess I would say that as we think about what creates good learning environments for our children and how do we build relationships with the people who are spending a lot of time with our kids, that the data is a really important piece of that. And it's not the only ingredient. And even though this is feeling very contemporary to me now because of a high school experience, I think back on my kids' younger and early childhood years when I would have similar conversations about we're not we didn't see three instances of this today. So we saw two instances of this today. So we don't really think it's a problem. And then the next day I would get that phone call saying, you need to come pick up Jack because he bit somebody today. So I think this goes back to, in some ways, the first question that as we build good relationships and we as parents with teachers and administrators and they with us as well, as we build those relationships, have those conversations and the experiences that we get in those relationships be also a part of the context in addition to the data being one data point, but not the full picture.
Yeah. And I appreciate the term context because you come at this from knowing your son in the context of everything else. And the school comes at this with the context of the school, where we're going to see a very different degree of performance. So I thank you for bringing that concept of context into this conversation and this question. Would anybody else like to take that question?
Yeah, I'm going to build off what Sarah talked a little bit about, which in policy, so I'm going to throw a little policy in there. In policy, there's no one measure that should determine eligibility or a need for accommodation or modifications. And so I always like to pick on the word evaluation. Evaluation and policy, if people don't know, is the process of determining eligibility. And it should be using multiple methods and multiple pieces of information, multiple experts. But it's a point in time. When IFSP is first 45 days, an IEP 60 days, and maybe a little data that maybe lasts 6 months or so. But it's a point in time. Assessment is what is really key. And that's that ongoing process of collecting data across time to see the effects of program. Is it being effective? How are we doing? And I'm connecting strongly with what Sarah's saying. When you look at one day in time, what happens if the kid had a really good day, was unusually good or unusually bad, right? We can see that. Same thing, standardized measures sometimes gets me really crazy because we have kids maybe who have attention or other issues. And if we try and sit down and say, we're going to test you all, it may change the actual accuracy or authentic measure. And so that's that one piece where I think it's really important for families. When an evaluation comes out or an assessment comes out or a report comes out, it's okay to say, that's not what I see it, or that doesn't match with how he's functioning. Yes, we can test this way. We know there's a capacity, but the reality is the function isn't matching what your test says in our day-to-day lives. I also encourage parents to keep data. I'm a big data person, but keep your data. How many times did you get a call from the school and point it back out to them? Hey, or in childcare, I got this many calls to come get my kid over the course of a year or a month or whatever. That's an issue. It's affecting my ability to work. It's affecting my child's ability to learn and access the curriculum. I think those are key pieces. I don't know if families really realize that they have a voice in this. Often I feel like evaluations as a parent, we feel like we're talked to. Here's the results. That's not the case. It's here are what we found. How does it match with what you know? And it should be then the team discussing and digesting it. I think that's huge. I don't think parents realize they can say, I don't see that in the same way.
And that's where that relationship comes in prior to any kind of meeting, prior to any kind of conversations that relate to the services that are going to be provided.
Or think about the ETR team or the IFSP team saying to a family, you're part of the evaluation team. We want to hear, we want to try these things. We may try to assess something and then we're going to ask you how it matches what's typical. Setting the stage for the engagement and involvement in the process all of the way through, whether eligible, not eligible, served, not served, like all of those pieces. How do we truly partner to make sure your child's unique learning supports are in place, regardless of where it's at in the plan, and that we're measuring and paying attention to whether they're effective or not. And we're adjusting to that based on what we see.
Mm-hmm. Beth, would you like to?
I will piggyback on that because I think another critical member of the team who isn't always asked is the classroom teacher. And especially in an inclusive classroom, the classroom teacher who doesn't have the bona fides of being a special education specialist, they are very observant individuals and they can see what's working. They can see what's not working. But oftentimes when it comes to the IEP meeting, they aren't always asked what they're seeing in the classroom and the things that they think would be effective interventions or accommodations and modifications. And so I think it's really important that we lift up the value of the classroom teacher and what they're experiencing and seeing.
Yes. And what you make me think about from Love as a Classroom. One of the things was that my teaching assistants had the opportunity to work with the children a little bit closer, especially at points in time where I had to focus on Javon more, or it's hard in inclusive classrooms when you've got especially all these other things, such as English language learners, and you've got behaviors and all those other things. So I think, Beth, absolutely the teachers. And I think that the consideration for what those teaching assistants who may not be as overwhelmed by paperwork and all the other, how do we run this curriculum? They can see things. And furthermore, my situation was that my teaching assistants spoke Spanish and I didn't speak Spanish very well. And so looking at that, also bringing the teaching assistants. Let's go into question number three. How can we build trusting, honest partnerships to change classrooms, schools, and district policies and culture so they are truly inclusive? And when I say truly inclusive, it means that everyone feels an unconditional sense of belonging and they have high access to every resource available in that classroom. So how do we build trusting partnerships to change policies and culture?
We would be really wealthy if we figured this one out, wouldn't we? This is something I've tried to touch on, tried to bring up. It's very touchy because what I've heard from many districts across the country and from EI professionals as well is there's no policy that would not allow inclusion. So they'll say their policies allow it. So the policy isn't there. So it's an implementation issue, maybe not a policy, the actual policy in and of itself. There's nothing that would prevent us from doing it. I think you hit it when you talk about culture. And as a parent who's walked through a child getting services from birth, who has some pretty involved intellectual just challenges to not being where her peers are, what I have seen every year is more restriction, more exclusion, or we mask it with what we call co-location. She's in the room, but she's with an aide. She's not learning the same stuff. She's not engaging with her peers. She's Velcroed to an adult. And so I think we have to be open and honest to talk about, I flip and try not to judge, but I try to ask the question. So how does that help her become a productive citizen and ready for the world as an adult? And it's one of those things I keep trying to ask those questions. And we have to ask those from leadership as well. So I tend to ask those when we're at meetings. The principal's there. I've had superintendent, director of people services, different people at my meetings. I try to keep bringing that up. The other thing that I think also that we have to look in culture are other families. There are families who also don't feel comfortable with their child being included, or they don't know what it looks like, or the practices to lead to inclusion opportunities doesn't support the child's learning in an authentic way. And so they're afraid their kids are not going to get supports and learning supports that they need. So it's a big sticky wicket on this one. And I think it's complex from both sides. But just like Beth experienced, it's getting someone to try it. Let's just go give it a go. I think there's an assumption of failure a lot. It just won't work. Rather than let's give it a go, we'll look at the data and we'll decide. So I think there's so many pieces in this loaded question, but that's where I would start having the conversations. And I'll let you guys piggyback off of it or pick apart that piece of it.
And I'll piggyback on that because the experience that we had with Raymond moving from his K through 8 school into high school was the high school was saying, oh, we can't accommodate his needs in the high school. And so we don't think we can do it. It's absolutely, you can do it because the evaluations that you're looking at are a year old. You're not looking at the current functioning of what he is doing and what he is able to do. But it made me so mad. But they had him spend a week at the high school to see if he could make it. No other student had to go through that in order to get into that high school. But that's the only way they would let him in is if he could survive a week and not have a meltdown and actually integrate in the classrooms and do okay, which he did just fine. Then they said, okay, we'll give him a try. But I think a large part of this is working with the base people that you have, your teachers, your specialists, and especially what Andrew said, the support people, the paraeducators who work with our kid to really help them start changing the culture that, yes, inclusion does work. And I think gradually it starts to trickle out to others because there's some examples of, yes, inclusion is working and this is how and this is why. I think in order to change district policy, I have to go through the finances because so many districts will say, but it's cheaper to have a resource room with one teacher and everything. when in fact, inclusion actually isn't any more expensive than having a specialized school or the resource room. And trying to pull out the data on the costs is tricky and it's time consuming, but those are the kinds of metrics that will change district policy. But the culture will change when families and teachers and in-service providers see that inclusion really is a very effective way of moving our kids through the school system.
Yeah, and we're at a point now where we have plenty of evidence to show that. We have demonstration sites. We've got all the mechanisms. We've got all the literature. Lots of advocates out there across social media, podcasts. And so perhaps there's just a tipping point. We need that tipping point, and then we can make those changes.
Now, I think if I could jump in here too, I think that one of the many things, Andrew, that I drew from reading Love as a Classroom is the sort of the internal dynamics among classroom schools and districts before it even gets to the parents interacting with those and just how important those are. And especially when there's conflict from within across those points of contact, classroom, schools, and districts. But I think also when there's a different mental model of what this could look like. And I think if we can figure out more and more robust and better ways to help create sort of these internal dynamics in which the mental model that classroom, schools, and districts have is more aligned with one another around inclusion and inclusion, not just inclusion policy, but as was said earlier, just how that's actually implemented and put into practice, that if we can align those mental models and ensure that before a parent or a group of parents even comes to the point of having these kinds of interactions about their children or with their teachers around their children, that the internal sort of workings and dynamics are feeling a bit more cohesive.
Yeah, what you pointed out is really important. It's in the book. There was the leadership that occurred at the school level, which was the principal. And Chris created a trusting, honest relationship with and among everybody in that school. But then it was juxtaposed with the district. And the district, on the other hand, they touted a very inclusive, they had their mission and their vision, but there was no harmony there. And so when we're talking about those internal mechanisms, those internal workings, what happens when the internal working of the classroom is really functional, but the school is not, or the school and the classroom are great, and it was the case in the book, but the district is not, or at least just that one district official, perhaps. What have your experiences been with those, and how did you address them? What did you do in those situations when there wasn't that harmony?
I have so many thoughts rattling in my brain because I think I've experienced all of those possibilities across time. In early years, great intervention specialist who really tried to make sure all the opportunities there, the support was there, supported the gen ed teachers, the general education teachers collaborating with intervention specialists and like really great things happening. An amazing principal who supported it and great things were really happening. And then we had a change in principal who had a different philosophy. It wasn't said, but it was surely felt about money. Every time we got into conversations, there was some undertone of, I'm not sure we can do that. And why? Because money should not be what we do. When it's an IEP, it's about what does that child do to be successful. But as a parent, I can understand I have to live in my budget. I've lived my own personal budget. So I appreciate district struggle, but that shouldn't be a reason. And like Beth said, the data shows that inclusion doesn't cost anymore. And there are benefits when we have peers as partners and really looking at that authentic interaction. But I've also had the flip where I had a really challenging teacher, but the principal got it, but the change wasn't happening. It was more of babysitting than really helping them get out and try new things. I think in all of those situations, I just kept talking and sharing what I saw was happening and how it affected my child's education. I just kept talking about it and just kept being the squeaky wheel at whatever level it needed to be. Sometimes things got fixed and sometimes they didn't. And that's the hard part. So I'm still here. This is still my district. And that's also it too, advocating at the district level. And actually, I will say, in one situation, I went to the superintendent over something. I said, why is this happening? Because my hands are tied. There's actually something that's happening at the state level. So I went and I did some work at the state level and advocated at that. Hey, this isn't working for our district. This is the policy there. How do we change it? And actually work through a committee to help get some things shifted. Ohio has a really messed up funding system and education system. We know it's not constitutional, but it's still there. So we just have to keep shedding light on what doesn't work, but then also offering a hand to help. It's that piece of it. This one's really tricky.
And I think it's really helpful to think about what kinds of issues are preventing these truly inclusive policies, cultures, and practices from happening. And I think this is a very broad brush approach, but I think generally things can be technical problems or they can be adaptive challenges. When we try and figure out what are some of the barriers to true inclusion and what kinds of technical problems are schools or districts or even classrooms encountering, whether it be around funding or technology or sort of some of those more technical challenges versus adaptive challenges, which I think are more around in some ways values and beliefs and partnerships and approaches and some of those sort of less concrete things. The more we can think about coming up with solutions and helping schools and districts to problem solve by maybe separating out in some ways, what are some of the technical problems versus adaptive challenges that could be helpful?
And I will say one of the things that I've experienced is more of, like you were saying, Sarah, a cultural thing, but also misconceptions about, oh, this child can maybe work in an inclusive environment, but not this child. And understanding why people have perceptions of the limitations that different diagnoses have, and getting people to actually see the child and the individual's strengths, because every child has strengths, and figuring out how to use those strengths within the classroom and to be a part of the classroom. My son was part of a video that was done called Song of Our Children about inclusion. And when the teacher showed the video to his eighth grade peers, they were actually mad because they said it showed him more disabled than we experience. And it didn't show the things that we know he can do and that we really appreciate. And for me, that was validation that inclusion really works for all kids.
I'm going to leave us to rest on that one. Thank you so much, Beth. Thank you for everybody who watches and views this. Thank you for your kindness and support with Love is a Classroom. I hope Love is a Classroom can help facilitate the conversations that we're just starting to seed and germinate. There's so much more we can talk about. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Memoir Love is a Classroom was written from my perspective, a teacher, but the book would not exist if it had not included the conversations documented from my interactions during the school year with Javon's mom, Chanel, her Facebook posts, and conversations we had while I was writing the book. I hosted the advocacy panel and started the podcast because I feel it is important for readers and listeners to have a deeper understanding of the family, teacher, school, school district partnership required for high quality, meaningful inclusion. It's much more than an individual teacher. Future series and episodes of this podcast will continue to shed light on the importance of the family, teacher, school, and school district partnership. Thank you for listening to Love is a Classroom, Stories of Inclusion. Please subscribe to the podcast, post a review, and share our episodes. You can follow us at Love is a Classroom on Facebook, Instagram, or YouTube. If you're a teacher, parent, or advocate who would like to share your story, please go to loveisaclassroom.com, click on contact, and share a brief summary of your experience. Until next time, choose love, choose inclusion.